Hello, and welcome to the Libertarian Podcast. I'm your host, Troy Senek, joined, as always, by the Libertarian himself, Professor Richard Epstein, Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution, as well as Professor of Law at NYU and Senior Lecturer at the University of Chicago. Today, the moon, 50 years on. And Richard, there have been a lot of commemorations over the last week or so of the 50th anniversary of Apollo 11 and the moon landing, including one from you in your regular column in the Las Vegas Review Journal. And over the course of the show, I want to take us beyond even some of the things in that piece, but we should start with that piece because this column that you wrote is a remembrance of your experience of the moon landing, but it's also kind of a commemoration of what it meant and almost a bittersweet one in some sense. So take us to July 1969 in your life and then tease out for us some of the themes that develop in this column.
This was a worldwide event, and the reason I remember this so well is I do not think of this as a case in which the eagle has landed. I was visiting my friend John Langbein and his soon-to-be fiancé in a place called Bopar, Germany, and when I watched the show, it was called Der Adler ist gelandet, and, you know, everybody was as rapt and attentive to the thing in Germany in the middle of nowhere as they were in the great cities both in Europe and in the United States. And what happens is it was an event the kind of which, you know, you really wanted to watch. Now, why is that? Well, there are a number of reasons. One is it was just the sheer question of suspense. It's really very hard for people to remember today just how much to the outer limits of capacity on technical sides that this particular venture went. So if you were trying to do the moon landing, say, 10 years later when computers were 100 times more powerful and engines were better and everything else was fine, one would have not thought of it as a romp on the park, but they would have not thought of it as a nail biter. And so what's happened, essentially, it's the end of the old technology is strong enough to get you over the hurdle, and so you don't have the suspense with the new technology. And the analogy that I gave was getting to the South Pole. If you looked at what Amundsen and Scott, who didn't know what he was doing, Amundsen did, to get to the South Pole. I mean, they were basically on the edge. By the time you get airplanes and better mechanized vehicles 10 years later, it's a walk in the park. You could do it as a kind of a tourist. So there's always the sense that what you're doing is you're getting there and you really have very little by way of security. And this, of course, became clear for the events that surrounded it. People forget that in 1967, Gus Grissom and a couple of other guys, they were burned while sitting there in a practice situation because there was a gas leak and they couldn't get them out of the particular module that they were in. They died of asphyxiation. And then we had this terrible problem with Apollo 13 where, you know, the thing didn't function and they had to improvise without a landing in order to get the landing module back to Earth in one piece. And I can still remember, as many people who were alive at the time could remember, when you go into these situations, there's radio silence as you first hit the atmosphere, and you can only find out what's happening afterwards. And there are three choices. You got about a degree of freedom on either side. If it turns out that you go in too shallow, you bounce out and you basically die in space on your way to Jupiter because there's no way to power you back. If you go a little bit too steep, and you know you could easily do that, then you're going to burn to death in the atmosphere, like happened with the situation on the reentry a couple of years ago. And so you're going to fry there. So you're sitting there and you got 90 seconds, 100 seconds. And when you hear that voice saying, you know, over and out, we're all safe, it's a visible sigh of relief. And these kinds of things, I think, really matter to the way in which it goes. So it's a matter of straight theater. It was simply something which you could not replicate today. Things are too easy. You could send all sorts of people to the moon now, and it's going to be a commercial venture. It's not going to be the lifetime. All right. The second thing, of course, about this is it was very heavily tied up to the space race and to the American-Russian conflict at that particular time. You know, "We will bury you" may have been a mistranslation of what it was that Khrushchev said to Nixon, but it was very clear that there was a big difference in strategies and a lot of stuff going on at that time. So I can still remember. I remember the day. I remember the headline in the newspaper in 1957. You know, the Sputnik goes up there, 184 pounds, and all of a sudden we're second banana in the space record. The strategy that the Russians had was less on small electronics and more on big engines. It's like Zhukov firing the artillery at the Germans in the end of World War II. And the United States specialized more in miniaturization. So when we put up our Explorer a couple of years later, it wasn't 184 pounds. It was like 6 pounds or 8 pounds or whatever it is. So people actually felt that we were behind them in this. And this came through in everything in the terms of the insecurity. So again, I'll just mention one other incident. One of the things that happened a couple of years before is there was a show called Air Power, which was hosted by a young and very vital Walter Cronkite. And I still remember the first episode. Now, this is 60 plus years later, in which what they do, the tensions that are now ratcheting up between the United States and Russia, what they do is they show us all of the defenses that we have in the North, in the Arctic, in Canada, and so forth, the Dew Line, or whatever they were called. They show our B-52s, which essentially have the power to take nuclear weapons with an 8-engine plane and drop them somewhere over Russia. And the Russians are coming, the tension's there, and you watch this thing, and the show ends when one of these things gets through and drops a nuclear weapon on some unidentified American city. It's just a hypothetical, but this was the kind of hypothetical that people actually believed had some degree of credibility. And, you know, you see that issue as a 13-year-old boy, and all of a sudden what happens is the world looks in a somewhat different way to you than otherwise, because it's the real age of anxiety. And you put those things together, and it turns out it's a non-replicable event, worthy of remembrance. And the third thing, of course, is the individual stories, the heroism, the skill of all of these particular people made them a kind of idol. It was a very conventional America at that time, because there were always stories about the astronaut wives, but there's no female astronaut. It was an all-white operation. You know, maybe that wasn't good, probably was bad, but this was not what people focused on. This was something in which conventional Americans managed to step up and do things that are greater than anybody thought that ordinary people can do. Huge team effort, huge celebration, huge amount of almost adoration of the way in which all of this stuff went on.
These days, you'll hear a lot of libertarians say, get NASA out of this business. There's all this pent-up entrepreneurial energy in the private sector for space, and they can do a better job of it anyway. And by the way, I mean, a lot of non-libertarians will make a similar case. So that, of course, would not have been as persuasive an argument in the 1960s or indeed for a good long while afterwards. But just taking this from the perspective of classical liberal principles, Richard, was it an appropriate task for government then? Is it an appropriate role for government now?
Well, it's a very interesting question, but the first thing that one wants to stress is somebody has said NASA, when all of this stuff was going on, virtually all of its employees who had active roles in this were in their late 20s, early to mid-30s. So this was kind of like a startup technology. By the time you see the sclerotic NASA working 20 and 30 years later, what happens is it's the same people, only they've lost one step, two step, or three step, but the median age goes way up. And at that particular time, the way in which people thought about this was this. This was part of the national defense effort, and so therefore it was a classic kind of a public good. There was no question that you built this thing through NASA, but the amount of subcontracting to private parties, which actually knew what they were doing, was extremely great. And I don't think there was much concern upon the part of anybody that this was somehow or other a mission that was bloated or misapplied. I think as government starts to go on, I would make a general point. When you have fewer functions that are done by government, and when you have a more kind of a business-like ethic, and you're not worried about inequities of one kind or another, you will do better in production than you will. So I would never want to trust anything like this to the current American government, because it's completely bloated. It has so many operations that are done for collateral reasons, it won't work. To give you a parallel on this, you look at any photograph of the CCC, the Civilian Conservation Corps. It was all white again. Remember, Roosevelt was not particularly sympathetic. He had a strong southern base, and he didn't do much to undo segregation on this stuff. And there were a bunch of guys, and they were marching eight across. They all had pickaxes, and they went, you know, a very long distance, and they managed to plant a billion trees, and they built God knows how many roads. You can still tell a road that was built in the 1930s by these people, because they all had these wonderful brick and stone places along the side, the Merritt Parkway in New York, the Pacific Coast Park, rather, in New York, Connecticut, rather, and the Pacific Coast Highway in California. They did this stuff, and they did it at a minimum, of course. Now you try to do the same thing again, you get all sorts of red tape, and you get Harry Reid saying, well, the first thing we have to do is to build a road that will take all those people to our casinos in Las Vegas from Los Angeles. And the whole process, the whole professionalization of government has gone way the world down. And I think it's important, if you're a classical liberal, to say that, you know, what you want to think about government is to some extent about what you think about the way in which government is put together. And I don't think during the periods that we're talking about, there was a huge amount of concern with bloat and graft in exactly the same way. Eisenhower supported the, you know, the interstate highway system, which generally people think was something of a success at the time, because it was done under much more competitive type situation. Now, of course, by the way, if you want to do this in the private sector, be my guest. First thing you have to do is to get an environmental rule view. Then you have to meet all the personnel requirements, yada, yada, all the way on. Here's just another tidbit. You remember there was an earthquake in Santa Monica a couple of years ago, 10, 12 years ago, and it knocked out the whole highway. And if you had to go through the standard environmental procedures to get this thing done, it would have taken you several years to finish it. So what they did is they said, we're going to waive all these things. We'll give these builders an incentive contract. So if you're late past a certain day, you pay a penalty. And if you're early, you get a bonus. They managed to do this thing in about one-tenth the time it would have taken if they had gone through the rest of it. And so you have to really calibrate what you think about government. And there's no question if you're talking about things that involve potential safety issues of one kind or another, carbon dioxide, whatever it turns out to be, both the public sector and the private sector are vastly weaker than they are today. So I think the real culprit is not so much the public-private choice on a defense-related project. I think it's the whole atmosphere of what we expect these projects to do and all of the non-performance items that are built into these particular programs, which make them both private and public much bulkier than they really ought to be.
Richard, seeing as we're potentially anyway on the cusp of this big private sector push into space and people fantasize about colonies and permanent outposts off of our planet, I wonder how we should think about that from a property rights perspective, where you've got a commons outside of the sovereign territory of any state and with significant barriers to entry, right? The number of players who can get themselves into space, let alone stake an enduring claim there, is pretty small. Walk us through that analysis.
Well, I mean, first of all, there's never going to be a situation where you'll have anything other than huddled masses sitting in these places trying to do various kinds of work. You want to figure out where you could put people. It's a lot easier to get them into the Antarctic than it is to get them to the moon. And, you know, we have nobody who lives there except people who are working in various kinds of scientific and maybe occasionally military type of exposition. The climate is too cold. There's nothing that you could really do there. You go to the moon, you know, the gravity is going to be too light. It turns out that you have no atmosphere. Therefore, it's an absolutely hostile environment that you must always be in a various kind of place. You know, people say they get cabin fever if they live in Hawaii. Oh my God. I mean, you go up to this place, it's just not going to be it. So I don't regard that as at all important, but I do think the scientific stuff is important. And you mentioned that it's a commons. It's an interesting feature. Generally speaking, the only things that used to be common, let's go back to our favorite subject, Roman law, with things like land and so forth, but the rivers and so forth were generally thought to be common, but land was something for the occupation. Well, the Antarctic sits on a mountain, and so presumably you could do it by first possession. But I think everybody rightly came to the conclusion that a first possession regime only works when you don't know that it's there. So when people go slowly westward and they take a piece of unoccupied land and 2 years later somebody moves in, fine. But if you're going to have a situation where there are going to be milliseconds separating my claim from your claim and so forth, it doesn't work. So what we did is we called it the common heritage of mankind and vetoed everybody from coming in, except to the extent that they are going to do certain kinds of military, or not military, scientific basis, where there's a kind of a committee that oversees it and apportions the various locations to people. And I think that's perfectly fine. But if one starts to think of the moon as a serious resource, you know, hell, you could go to 1,000 places in California, which are quite empty at this particular point, which are going to do a lot better by this. I just saw a little figure today. You know, somebody said you could basically have people living quite comfortable in California if the population were 1 billion people. I mean, just that much empty land. And, you know, if you don't want to move to some of those mountains, which are not even owned today, you're certainly not going to want to move to the moon. So I think you treat it as a scientific stuff. I think the institutions that we have are probably reasonably tolerable. Fortunately, I don't think there's any military advantage for being on the moon in terms of your ability to strike somebody else. And the much more serious place for military purposes is the lower and the upper atmosphere, where you do have spying cameras and you could keep strategic weapons going. And there's enough space junk there that you You can knock out very, very expensive things. And for that, I do think we need a more powerful and more coherent international order. But if this were not the 50th anniversary of the moon landing, I don't think anybody would be seriously talking about any of these sort of settlement and occupation and development issues on the moon.
So final question for you. If you really dig into the history of the moon landing, and you can see this, for instance, in the new Apollo 11 documentary, you recognize, as you said earlier, what a close-run thing this was and such a huge technological leap. I mean, if you zoom out and think of it as a historical matter, you go from the Wright brothers being airborne for less than a minute in 1903 to man walking on the surface of the moon in just about 65 years. As a result of this, something I imagine drives a classical liberal like you crazy. It has become a trope, especially among people on the left, and we've already heard it a lot in the early days of this presidential campaign, that for any big government endeavor, the justification will be if we can put a man on the moon, we can do X. And I probably shouldn't even put this in overly partisan terms, because you will hear this in service of bipartisan plans like government efforts to cure cancer. If that analogy doesn't work, and I'm going to presume you think it doesn't, why is the logic non-transferable? Why, with a sufficient amount of resources and a sufficient amount of will, can't government accomplish these huge goals given what we saw from NASA in the 1960s?
Well, NASA had a very specific mission and a very specific target. And it had a very simple metric to figure out something is going to succeed or fail. Either you got there or you did not get there. And it turns out if you have a final goal, you also have intermediate goals. You know, you have to circle the Earth first, and then you have to have docking stations of one kind or another. Then you have to improve the rocketry. So that I think you could do. Now, what you're talking about, why can't we cure cancer? Well, it turns out it's a goal, but you don't know when you've cured it. There are 15, 20, 30, 50, 100 different kinds of cancers. There are several hundred different pathways that you could try to use to attack these sorts of things. It's not at all clear who's going to do this as opposed to private public functions and so forth. That's a very diffuse and very difficult issue. And in fact, you know, we do have all sorts of advances in this. But the interesting thing is, if you're interested in science, as I am, you very, very suspicious of big science. That is, you don't want centralized control of this to take place and to rule it. One of the reasons why the NIH has been so successful is that it doesn't operate as a master agency that gives things out with government blessing. What it does is it has areas, it sets up independent panels, it tries to put experts on those panels, and then you try to get some kind of a competitive application system to figure out who gets these grants and who does not. And it's remarkably the same way as in which private granting agencies start to give out their particular kind of money. Well, you try and run competitive moon landing programs, forget about it. Nothing is ever going to happen under those circumstances. The front-end capital is too big. And then if you sort of say, well, now let's really fix something like get the appropriate level of carbon dioxide, fix the workforce and so forth, the reason you're going to fail on that is most of the people who insist that they know what the answer is are barking up the wrong tree. Very few of these people have the slightest affection for competitive markets to deal with any of these problems. Most of them are not really very good in trying to figure out what's the kind of externality that's worth stopping and what's not worth stopping. So just to mention one thing, I mean, the latest report I've heard on global warming is that the world is going to come to end in 15 hours or 15 months or whatever it is. Well, there are a couple things to talk about that. And no matter what you tried to do with the human control of emissions, you could not within a year change the temperature by more than a hundredth of a degree, if you could even do that. And it's not even clear if you know what's going on there, whether you want to treat positive, you know, carbon dioxide as a positive or a negative element, or positive to some levels and negative to another. These are just infinitely more complicated kinds of problems requiring international cooperation and all the rest of that stuff. So the moon landing is an engineering problem. One of the things, you know, I've spent a bit of time around engineers. I'm a part-time fellow at Texas A&M, and I get a little bit chance to watch them there. I've seen the same thing at Stanford where I'm a fellow at the Hoover Institution. These guys are geniuses at team production for defined tasks. And in fact, I've always think that the best people to run universities in many ways are the engineers, because unlike the mathematicians and the lawyers and so forth, they're used to running complicated institutions. Nobody is under the delusion that there's one person who can engineer a complex system. They always break it down into small parts, put them back into larger parts, so they know how to do this. But as we know, Jimmy Carter was an engineer, and he wasn't such a great president. So I think these analogies are way off. I do believe that the correct model for government, and I'll end on this moment, is sort of decentralization with respect to the improvement of productive capacities and having a government which concentrates on two issues. One is to protect against the untoward spillovers, and I mean those relatively narrow, noise, pollution, and things of that sort, and those people who are willing to enforce voluntary arrangements that don't work as contracts in restraint of trade. That's a fairly short summary of what's going on. I wish that we followed it today. But unfortunately, for the most part, we do not.
All right. Thank you, Richard. And thank you to our listeners. Remember, you can follow Richard on Twitter at Richard A. Epstein. You can read his weekly column, The Libertarian, by visiting Defining Ideas at hoover.org. And you can help us out by rating the show on iTunes. For Richard Epstein, I'm Troy Senek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution. For more information about our work, please visit hoover.org.